that's not going to bother anybody. All right, Jarrett, come on up.
All right, am I audible here? Am I audible at this level? Okay.
A little louder.
Okay, I'll try to be louder. I'm not naturally a loud talker. I'm Jarrett Knight, as you know, and some of you may have met my wife, Amanda, and our five-month-old son, James. They were here for the service but had to leave shortly after because James was very overdue for a nap and on the verge of a meltdown. So, but I run a ministry in Farmville called Cogito, and it is at both Hampton Sydney College and Longwood University, mainly at Hampton Sydney at this point. And what we do, a good way of thinking of what we do is sowing seeds. We do a lot of discussion groups on different topics that have to do with Christianity, with theology, and various aspects of academic learning or of culture. So in the past year or so, I've done 7 or 8 different study groups, about 3 or 4 a semester, on topics that include the short stories of Dostoevsky, who is a Russian Christian writer, works by Kierkegaard, who is a Danish Christian theologian, studies on books of the Bible like Genesis and Revelation. We did a group called On the Nature of Love in Christian and Classical Tradition at Longwood and online. And most recently, I did a group at Hampton Sydney on C.S. Lewis's book Till We Have Faces. And there's actually an online version of that group right now that we're doing just for anyone who was interested in the area. So we do a lot of these groups. They tend to be smaller, you know, sometimes as many as 15 students, but more often around 10, perhaps fewer. And this generates really good and interesting and I think sometimes deep discussion as we think together about what these different people have to say to us and about what Scripture has to say to us. And I think these kinds of discussions can plant seeds that will unfurl in some really good ways later on. In addition to that, we do lectures, usually on Hampton City's campus, at least a couple times a semester. This past semester, we did one called Credo ut Intelligam, the meaning of faith seeking understanding, and had a philosophy professor from, I think, I always get these messed up, I think it was Bethany College, came and gave it to us. And then we had a couple other given online. One was on Tolstoy and Russia in the Light of the Present Catastrophe was the title of it. And the other was called Athens and Jerusalem, which is a lecture on philosophy and theology. This upcoming semester, we have planned a group on 2 Corinthians, and I'm planning for there to be an online version of this group as well as the one at Hampton Sydney. So if anyone is interested, you can check out our website, and you'd be welcome to sign up for that. It'll probably be about an 8-week study once a week for an hour on 2 Corinthians. We will also have one on a book called After Virtue, which is a book on ethics that was written by a philosopher in the 20th century named Alistair MacIntyre. And then we'll have another group on prayer, and then a fourth one, the exact content of which is yet to be determined, but it'll sort of be an introductory group for students at Hampton Sydney. And then in addition to this, there will be another group, probably on the Gospel of Mark, that will be at Longwood. So that's the fall semester for us. And we'll also have at least one lecturer coming in to talk about contemplative prayer this September. So I'll try to make sure y'all are informed of that once I get more details on it. The person who's giving it is both a theologian and a poet. So I'm very interested to hear what he has to say. I'm trying to think of anything else. Does anyone have any questions for me or for what for what we do. And, you know, the Faith Bible Fellowship has been the supporter of Cogito, I think, basically since the ministry began under Missy DeRegibus. So that's always very grateful to you all and for your generosity in supporting us in the way that you have.
Is it only
Yeah, so usually I will do one online group each semester that is for anyone who wants to join, and we meet via Zoom. All the rest of the groups are for students, but the lectures are open to the public, so anyone can come who wants to.
When do you meet?
Where do we meet? In the past, it's been a room in Upchurch, up on the, I think the third or fourth story. I don't remember exactly where.
Do you have, what's your relationship with the professors out there?
I know a number of professors at Hampton, Sydney, and actually the philosophy professors have been pretty interested in what we're doing. I'm good friends with the classics professor, with some of the folks in religion as well, and actually this past semester was the first we had a couple of professors co-lead groups. So there was, well, actually, you all know Torrance. Torrance co-led a group with us for part of the semester. And then there was also a professor who is in economics. Yeah, right, economics? Yeah. Who, sorry, who did one of the other groups.
We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who did you have connection with in the classics department?
Rob Irons.
Oh, of
his name.
Of
yeah.
Course. Yeah. I was thinking of the other two, and they're Jewish, and I was just wondering.
Yeah.
Do they join any of your classes?
The two professors who led have joined in them, and then one philosophy professor joined a group last summer. But other than that, no, professors haven't joined in yet. I think they might yet in the future. We'll see. They've come to a number of the lectures, actually.
You've done some of the lectures in cooperation with the philosophy department, haven't you?
Yeah. Which ones? Well, the one this semester on Faith Seeking Understanding mm-hmm. was, I think, co-sponsored by the philosophy department. And then there was another one. The title. Oh, it was called Secular Reasons for God that we did in the fall that the philosophy department co-sponsored.
So the classes that are at Longwood are for undergraduates.
Yeah. Well, any student can join. And really, we've had fewer study groups so far with Longwood because we're not an official student organization there. Up until this semester, it was actually Amanda who had been doing the Longwood groups, but I took over after she had James. And she's actually beginning to teach at Longwood in the fall, so I'll be taking over the Longwood groups. So.
Is it possible you could become an official?
It is. We need to have enough students to do it, and they have to put together something like a constitution.
Okay.
So it'll require a little bit of legwork, but I think we might be able to get there. Where I've actually reached out, there's a relatively newly formed Christian group on Longwood's campus called Invitation to Freedom. I think students formed it themselves, so I've gotten in touch with the folks who are in charge of that. To see if there's anything I could do to help them out.
So how has life changed since James came along?
Well, you know, I realized that before James was here, I had had a lot more time than I realized that I had, which is now involved in caring for him. That's been good. Yeah, he's not mobile yet, but he sure does take a lot of time. It's been good. It's actually forced me to discipline myself a lot more because I know I have a minimum of yeah.
That's right. Well, I had been a student at Longwood and I could enroll yet. I still be a student.
There you go.
Yeah.
But with my age and income, I can do it for free.
Cool.
Yeah, that's neat.
Not many adults know that. But
yeah.
It's true.
My brain would help me.
So I may have to do that in order to get into some of the fun.
Yeah.
I love the other people.
Yeah, well, you'd be welcome to do the ones on Zoom, too.
But I like the interaction with you.
Yeah, the in-person
that's
group.
My daughter granddaughter dropped out during the pandemic from Duke. She just could not do the boom. And I'm more that way, I guess.
Yeah,
I can, I've tried it, but I just don't. I just like to ask a question.
Yeah, I can understand that.
So you guys just graduated a couple from your group, I think I saw on your letter.
Yes.
What's your average? I know the school had started.
So the total number of students at Hampton Sydney who have been involved in some way is probably 25 to 30. Not all of those come to a study group in a given semester. And some of them will come to a study group for maybe half a semester and stop. But I think that's a good approximation. And then there are probably five or six who were involved at Longwood at this point. There were more at the beginning of the semester. But what has happened there is we have a couple of professors who will tell their students, you can do this group. And you'll get some extra credit if you do it for the semester. And so they sort of send us some students.
So you have some unbelievers.
So there are students who, some who are Christians and some who are not, some who would say they used to be Christians. So it's a wide range, I think. I would say probably two-thirds to three-quarters would say they're some kind of Christians. Maybe more like 80%. I think sometimes historically that percentage has been a little bit lower, but I think that's about what it has been. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, we got like 10 in Dan.
Yeah. Yeah, and then James last year. But
is there a charge to the online class?
No, there's no charge. Anyone can sign up. So.
Did you want to introduce the student you have with you now?
Sure. Would you like to be? Well, I guess you have to be introduced now. This is Zach Mowbray. He's Zach just finished his freshman year. He's majoring in religion and in philosophy, and he's also studying Greek and Latin. And
but I can't talk to this guy.
Yeah. And Zach
from Buckingham.
He's from Buckingham, and he likes to read and reads a lot.
That's the kind of student you attract, I assume.
Yeah, I think a lot of the students who do the groups that we have are those who are interested in really thinking about things seriously and deeply, and they take the groups that I offer, which involve weekly readings, for no tangible benefits to themselves. So they'll actually come and read sometimes quite difficult books and come and talk about them just because they want to. So it's a neat and unusual group of people who do Kogato, and I'm very grateful to have the students that I do. What's that? I hope so.
All right, Jared, thank you. Much appreciated.
Next on the list, my daughter Kyra, and I think everybody here knows her, but she's been in Romania I'll let you tell it all.
Hello. Thank you guys for letting me chat for a few minutes today. I have some notes here that I made before I spoke at my dad's Rotary Club a few weeks ago, so I'm not really going to use them. They're just here. So, I think you guys know me a little bit better. But I am in Kyra Markin, John and Sherry's daughter, and I have been teaching at an international school in Bucharest, Romania for the last 3 years. It's a very diverse community of students. There are a number of Romanian families. The largest demographic in the secondary school is Asian families, a number of Chinese and Korean students. And then I also have students from Kenya and Brazil and the U.S. and the U.K. and Russia and now Ukraine. We have a number of Ukrainian students, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. So it's been an interesting experience there. It is all instructions in English at the school. And so for a number of these international families, of course, they would rather have put their students in a English program than a Romanian program. It's going to be much more useful to them in the future. So Bucharest, Romania is not Budapest, Hungary, although apparently Michael Jackson and many others like Metallica have been on stage there and said, "Hello, Budapest," and mixed them up, not realizing what country they were in. So if you mix them up, but I have been there since 2019. And so if you heard me share last summer, you know that I had been there only a few months before COVID hit, and there were very, very strict lockdowns for the whole spring semester into the summer of 2020. So very strict travel restrictions. There were a couple of months we weren't allowed to leave our apartments without having paperwork filled out for every instance that we left the apartment, even to go get groceries or exercise. And if you exercised, you had to look like you were exercising if the police stopped you. So make sure you dressed accordingly. So it swung for a while. There were a lot of restrictions. And so I like to tell the story. This past semester, things were opening up, and the organization that I'm with, Teach Beyond, had a teachers' conference in Slovenia. So I was like, it's in Eastern Europe, it's perfect, it'll be easy to get there. So I was going to finally travel a bit and leave Romania, really for my first time since being there. I have had the chance to travel and see the Transylvania Mountains and hike in Romania, which I love. But over spring break, I planned to travel, and so it worked out, and I was happy about this, that I was going to have an 8-hour layover in Warsaw, Poland, on my way. Doesn't make any sense on the map, right? But this is the way the cheap airlines work in Europe. So I was excited. I was going to walk around Warsaw for a few hours and then get on the plane and head to the conference. And so I did. I was there early in the morning on Saturday, walked around, walked up the river, walked through Old Town, and then it started raining. And so I stepped into a coffee shop, looked at the map, and I said, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to stop raining. I will go walk to a bus stop that's fairly close by. So I'll see a little bit more of this street. I was on the iconic street that you see in pictures. I'll walk a little bit more, see it in the rain, take a different bus route to the airport, and see a little bit more of Warsaw in the rain. And then I walk out the coffee shop, and there are police lining the streets everywhere. Everything's blocked off for the major street running east and west and the major street running north and south. And I was sort of close to the intersection, right in the center of the city. And I was a little confused, and I finally said to a policeman, "Excuse me, do you speak English?" And he leaned in, he said, "Yes." I said, "Can you tell me what's going on?" He said, "The president of the U.S. is about to come through." And so I thought, that's why there were police all along the river and everything else. I was like, what is happening today? And so anyway, I have never been this close to the president's motorcade, even though I grew up 3 hours from D.C. And I said, well, I guess I'm not getting to the airport, because I was on the north side of the city and the airport's in the south. And I heard other people asking, like, the metro, you can't go underground, the metro's not running, no public transportation's running. So I said, if you can't beat them, you join them, right? So I stood on the side of the street and eventually did make it to the airport, but it was more of an adventure than I had intended. So, of course, the reason was because Poland, more than any other country at the time in early April, had received, I think at the time, over 2 million refugees, or at least now from Ukraine, and, right, the NATO response and all of that made lots of discussions were happening in Eastern Europe. So I tell that story to say this past semester, things began to open up with COVID, but then, of course, Romania was, not to the same extent as Poland, but still to quite a large extent, affected by the influx of refugees from Ukraine. And so when we first heard rumors of it and we were hearing about it on February 24th, I think it felt like our neighbors were under attack. My teenage students didn't really know what to think. Their parents had sent N95 masks for threat of nuclear attacks, right? So we had just lifted some restrictions, and now they're bringing the really serious masks, and they're like, why is the sky a weird color? You know, just lots of fears. The students didn't really know what to expect, right? And of course, there were some news saying the debris will reach here, and of course, nuclear threat would certainly reach southern Romania. So there was a lot of uncertainty, right? No one knew how quickly things would escalate or what would happen. And it had been an unusually mild February, very, very mild. And then the weekend and the weeks following everything happened, it dropped below freezing. There were icy rain constantly. And we were hearing stories of people on the border, some for 48 to 72 hours, unable to get through. Well, it just took so long to get everyone through. And so all of the countries that border Ukraine, Poland, Hungary, Moldova, and Romania, were receiving these refugees in cars, on foot. Some had strollers and suitcases. Some had nothing. They fled very quickly. And so I was amazed being there and being part of an international church there and being part of an international community at school, but also having good friends in Romanian churches, at how people responded so quickly and pulled their strengths, right? How quickly people can organize and work together toward a common goal. It was just amazing to watch. So lots of people just piled vans and cars and anything they could and took blankets and medicines and supplies to the border. They crossed the border and handed it out to the people in line waiting to cross. They opened their homes and their apartments and very quickly organized a network, right, to help place people in places that were safe and to try to preempt some of the trafficking stories that were horrible that you may have heard about, because there were children. I think 3,500 to 5,000 children have crossed the border alone just into Romania, right? And Romania hasn't been the largest border crossing, right? So lots of children on their own, women and children, because, of course, men from 18 to 60 or 70 aren't allowed to leave Ukraine. And I even know of some handicapped people that were trying to cross the border, and a man was their primary caregiver, and he wasn't allowed to cross. So just some vulnerable people. So people driving to the border. At first, we weren't even sure if they would make it as far south as Bucharest. Borders Ukraine in the east and the north around Moldova, but it only took a couple of days for there to be an influx of refugees into Bucharest. There has been over 1 million refugees who have come through Bucharest, and at least, last I checked, 85,000 of them can be accounted for as having stayed in Bucharest. And so it was amazing to watch the people that I'm connected to respond to this. The church very quickly partnered with other churches and made a list of people who could host and how many people they could host. And then from there, the needs got more specific. Is it handicapped accessible? Can you get someone in a wheelchair in? Can you take a pet? You know, because people had fled with their cats and their dogs, and all of these things. And so, I put my name on the list, I talked to my roommate, and then I think within 4 or 5 hours, I said, can you take someone tomorrow? And so I had a girl named Deanna come and stay with us, and she stayed with us for the longest amount of time. She stayed with us for quite a while, and she came very early. She left early in all of the process. And we would share meals together, and she would have her phone on the table and say, I'm so afraid to pick this up and look at it because I'm afraid of news from home, but I'm also afraid to not pick it up and look at it because I'm afraid of not hearing news from home. And so just this constant fear and not being sure and the uncertainty. She had money in her bank account, but wasn't sure if she'd be able to access it for very long. She did not know anyone in Bucharest. She very quickly connected to other Ukrainians. She owned her apartment in Odessa and had a job, and now she felt completely displaced. She's like, I can work, I can do things, you know? She said, can I close the windows at night? Because any sort of ambulance sirens or noises startled her so much. Within a couple of weeks, she said, now everyone I know has left Ukraine. I don't know anyone back there except for my mom and her aunt. The sirens were going off nonstop. but her mother still would not leave. She had only packed a few clothes. She said, I thought I'd only be gone a week or two and then be able to go back. And so she only had just a few clothes. She thought I should have brought more. She just had no idea what to expect when she first came. Her mother did eventually leave Odessa, but only for a couple of months. She didn't want to humanitarian visa. She didn't want to apply for refugee status. You have 90 days in the EU if you won't take that status. And so they have now returned to Odessa, and she does still message me updates. But that's just a snapshot of the woman that first stayed with us. I have sat across the table from others who have shown me the footage back home. There has been lots of networking. There's groups of translators who have been going to the train station to meet the people coming off the trains or the bus station and helping them find a place. There have been people, there's a WhatsApp group of drivers. That's their messaging app of choice. A WhatsApp group of drivers. So the embassies, if they need paperwork, the embassies aren't as accessible by public transportation. If someone who has medical concern needs to make it to a doctor. There's all these drivers that are just on a list, and the needs go out, and a driver is willing to take them. So translators, drivers, accommodations, that is still ongoing. There's an onward logistics group where someone would say, I've got a family that's trying to get to Germany. They've got cousins there. What paperwork do they need? And someone helping with all of that paperwork. And then there's a volunteer group for other needs, cleaning, stocking some of these houses that are the first stop for these people when they come across the border, helping refugees find jobs, sending carloads full of stuff to the border, and actually into Moldova now, because there's quite a drastic shortage in Moldova, which if you followed the news at all, you know that for a small country, I think, oh goodness, by May or something, 10% of the people in Moldova were Ukrainian refugees on top of their own supply shortage. So they've just completely flooded and complete shortage of medicines and things like that. So they don't love stuff coming over the Romanian border, but I've never known a vehicle not to get through. They just ask a lot of questions. So that was a little bit personally, watching people just so quickly coordinate these groups and figure out where their strengths lied and how to coordinate and respond. And the government did as well. All the public transportation in the city was free if you had a Ukrainian ID. I think this has continued to be the case. There's been a shift now. It's less of a traumatic response, like people showing up with nothing, and more of, we now have a whole bunch of people that need a place to stay. They're not permanently here in Bucharest, they hope, but they need rental contracts for 3 or 6 months, or you know, they need support for a year. They need somewhere for their kids to go to school for a short amount of time. And so instead of having whole stadiums and houses full of refugees now, the needs have shifted. They need jobs. It may even be a policy that they don't have to sign a 12-month contract. I know a lot of options for 3 or 6 months. So there's just been a very efficient response to meeting these needs. And I read a story about a first responder on the eastern border of Ukraine and Romania who developed an extensive operation to help people when they first came across the border. And there were medics and volunteers, border officials. They're all working together. All these agencies are working together to respond to this flood. And he said in the first weeks of the war, their boat that was ferrying people across the river there would sometimes pile on 800 people in a single trip across the river. It was just crazy. And he said it was traumatizing for the people on the boat, but it was traumatizing for the authorities on this side too, he said. Just the things they were seeing and the sheer number of people. And there is some political history here. No one in Eastern Europe really loves their neighbors. Maybe that's the simplest way to put it. But Romanians and Ukrainians, they have their own border disputes on the Black Sea, right? And they've got, it's like sibling rivalry, you know? But they don't necessarily generally think too highly of each other. But when he was asked why these border officials would work with these volunteers and would work with all of these, he said, I would use only one word, empathy, right? So for all of their banter and maybe less than playful back and forth with Ukrainians. When it comes down to it, I think that this struck a deep chord in Romanians. Poland too, right? They've so often been the ones under attack, and I think receiving these people did feel some solidarity and some shared culture with these people. So the school I'm at so in March and maybe early April, we did take a number of Ukrainian families. They arrived earlier. They just needed a place to stay. And so we did what we could to fit them into ELL classes if they needed English support, and to provide a stable place. So sort of our short-term goal was simply to give them a stable place. There are even some families that said, I know my child doesn't speak much English, but if they are, if they're at home thinking all day, they've just been through too much and seen too much for this to be a good thing for them. So they just wanted them to have some structure and to be with people during the day. So we had a number of families that sort of just wanted a short-term place to plant their kids. And so there are now some, I think that has shifted too, even this summer, messaging some families who have said, I'd love to take my family back to Kyiv, but it just isn't possible right now. There's no infrastructure there. We don't have any schools for them. And so do you have room for us for another year? So I think like short term, I think they're still hoping it's short term, but now short term means a few years, right, until things are rebuilt. And so we do have, continue to have a number of Ukrainians. It does amp up our need for ELL classes because the students that have been there and have been in English for many years, you know, are hoping to go to university, maybe in Europe or back in their home country, and they're on one track. And then we have students that need a lot of English support. So there's more to distinctly defined tracks at the school now. Ukrainians, unlike almost everywhere else in Eastern Europe, anyone who is, I don't know, 50 or 60 and younger is going to speak some English enough to communicate well with me. But except for Ukrainians, which of course they all speak Russian, and then Ukraine, either one can be their first language. So most of them speak very little English. So it does increase dramatically our need for English ELL classes. But it has been really interesting and humbling to watch a community work together kind of on the outside, but also to be able to have people into our home and just to hear stories and to sit at tables with people at church. So God is definitely working. There was a woman I was going to ask prayer for, Alina, who has connected with my church in Bucharest, and she is from Nikolaev, which is east of Odessa, and so in a pretty clear line of threat right now, constant sirens and things, and she has regularly come and has part of where the support money has gone has been to get a car for her because she came one weekend to Bucharest, and she said it was the first time she had been to church since everything started. I saw her in June before I traveled back. Because there's been so much going on and so many needs that she's working to meet. And she posts pictures and videos of just some tough stuff that her church there is dealing with. And so she's doing a lot to encourage believers and to also cross the border and then to go back to take things to these people in the community there. So just some interesting people that I've been introduced to. And so, yeah, appreciate your prayers, too, for the school. So it'll be, I think it'll be, this year will be more settled than the past semester, where we're sort of like, okay, this is just a space for them to be, and now we want a little bit more structure and want to have them, you know, more active in classes and that sort of thing. So this will be a little bit more of a traditional school experience for them, rather than a quick response at the end of the year. So that's a little bit about what I've been doing.
How did the students in your school respond to the influx of Ukrainians?
Usually they're pretty excited about new students. They're, especially the like middle grades, middle schoolers, but, mostly fine. There was a little bit because we have a family of Russians. And so the secondary student, there was a little bit, maybe not as bad as I was concerned it might be. I think some of that conflict was worked out before we got the Ukrainians, but certainly I think, they responded okay. I mean, they responded okay. I think there was a lot of fears, and so we did sort of tell them before when we heard that the that the Ukrainians were coming, we told them, remember that they are a lot closer to this, so if they want to share something, but don't impose your fears on them. You're much more removed, you know. Talk to us, talk to someone else about your fears. Let them express what they're comfortable with so that they're not asking difficult questions of someone that isn't prepared to talk about it. So,
yeah. What is a typical school day like?
So it's ACSI school. It's very similar to an American curriculum school. So 8 to 3 o'clock. We have, you know, a lot of the similar classes. A little bit more of an more rigorous ELL program because we do take a lot of Romanian students that come in and need a lot of English support.
Are you a
I'm high school. I'm high school, and then we do it's secondary. So like I'm with the 7th through 12th graders. So
they're all combined.
They're not all combined, but I mean the secondary school is 7th through 12th. So I teach English classes to different levels, 7th through 12th, throughout the day.
How many students are in one class?
Oh, usually between 12 and 15, usually. Yeah, right in there. So it's not huge, but it's a good size.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you teach like an English teacher in the
U.S.? Yeah, I am like a literature teacher. I do some of the ELL. Yeah, I do. I do. I do literature and some history. I've done some history. So we do. They have the traditional literature classes, and then there's a lot of English language classes for the ones that need it. And so we have
both. Take how she thinks outside. Maybe she doesn't think outside the box. That may not be the right phrase. But every high school co-op class that I taught, I made them read this book called Red Scarf Girl. And it was about the Chinese, the Red Revolution, Mao Zedong and that era. And anyway, Kyra wanted her class to read that book. I was like, let's all read this book and discuss it. Kyra said, let's all read this book and discuss it. And have the author zoom in.
No, that was my students. They were like, can we talk to her?
So
I looked her up.
Back in the late, somewhere in the 90s, maybe, I don't know.
Well, I have a lot of Chinese students who were very interested. So it was a world literature class where I wanted to explore some of these different facets. So, yes, we read Red Scarf Girl, which raises a lot of interesting questions about communism and the Cultural Revolution, which I have Romanians, Russians, Chinese, and so it's a really interesting discussion for them. So we did have the author come and speak, and that was an interesting... Zoomed in, yeah. But they really, really were like, she's going to come talk to us. They were so excited.
So, you know,
all those
subjects that are with your English, I mean, when you, do you have Romanian?
I have taken Romanian classes in the summer, some intensives. We do offer Romanian, but usually they're either native speakers or they know enough to get around if they're the Chinese or something like that. But we have a more traditional curriculum. So we've offered French and Spanish, usually one at a time, right? Because, you know, we've got like 55 to 60 students in high school, so that, you know, we're only offering one at a time. But yeah, so it's a more traditional curriculum, but then, of course, we have a slant toward Romanian history and language because we're there.
That's what I was getting at. Yeah. Because, I mean, I didn't know how different English classes were in Romania than they are.
Yeah, I mean, it would be the same as an ELL class here. Like, we actually, some of the curriculum we use in middle school is written more for Spanish speakers in the U.S. It's a little weird. All these names like Jose, which makes no sense to a Romanian learning English, but that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to come to Bard.
I just wondered about numbers. Like, so how many students are there total? And like, how many Ukrainians? So you're saying a third of them are Romanians.
Yeah, a third of them are Romanians in secondary. The secondary is slanted toward the Asians for a lot of reasons. They're an interesting discussion in themselves. So the younger ones have more Romanians. So, yeah, so in secondary, we're probably like 65 students, seventh grade and up. And then, 20 Romanians. The interesting thing about the Chinese families is that they want their kids immersed in Chinese culture until about 5th or 6th or 7th grade. So they send them to live with extended family or tutors in China, bring them back, anywhere between fifth and as late as ninth grade and put them for the first time in an English environment. And some of them see it as an opportunity and embrace it. Others struggle a lot. I had a girl write an essay her senior year about how when she moved back in eighth grade, her parents were like living with new roommates because she'd never lived with her parents. They want them back. So they send them in China. They send them back to China, but then they bring them to Romania where the parents are for the last 5, 6, 7 years of their education, and some of them that transition is very difficult. So secondary, we actually have a lot of Chinese. There's a number of Koreans all the way up, Romanians all the way up, but because of that, we have a lot more in secondary than in primary, whereas primary, there's a lot of Romanian families that want something other than Romanian school, usually Christian families. Most of the Romanians are Christian families looking for something that will teach critical thinking. Romanian schools are still rote memorization. The teacher writes on the board, you memorize it. And a lot of them, especially the Christians, want something else. They've gotten a taste of Western influence and want something else. So, yeah, there's, each demographic is very interesting, what brings them to the school and what their motives, you know, what they're looking for. Yeah.
They pay themselves well. They have to pay.
So that is an interesting question. There are some missionary kids. So there are some of them do pay. So the Chinese and others who are there for business, usually these businesses that they're doing actually, especially the Chinese businesses there, actually part of the income is education is the, so they pay a little bit. Nothing like the American school attached to the embassy, nothing like an expensive international school. So they pay a little bit. The missionary families, either the parents are involved in some way or they pay. So it's sort of a collaborative effort, right? And then the Romanians, we do, like supplies, books, you know, like enough to pay the rent. And so most of the teachers are there pretty much on full support, but there is a little bit required. So there's actually a tiering. They all get their own letters. It's a little bit awkward to me at first, but it sort of works with the community just as far as like expectations and what they need and what... The Chinese also require a lot of paperwork from us. So, you know, it's sort of just each demographic sort of has their own tiering. At first, I thought it was really weird. But then I realized I think they're trying to meet the needs of each demographic and still function as a school and have what we need. So so there are some, like the Romanians and the missionary kids. Because it was sort of founded as a ministry for those groups, they pay very, very little. And then if their parents do are involved in some way, they can knock off even more. So, sort of a strange, interesting to me system.
How do you grade them?
A lot of my classes is pretty similar to here. Pretty similar. They want to be challenged. They've worked hard. Most of the ones I am grading essays for are good at English. They've worked hard.
Have they found
any? I do have a couple of Chinese students right now who are pretty close, I think. But
anybody else have any questions? All right, let's just spend a few minutes praying for Jared and Kyra, and then I'll close it down.
Do you want this?